Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Sullivan County leaders are deciding how to spend $2 million to tackle the region's housing crisis. Could the money go toward new construction, fixing up existing homes, or creating a housing trust? Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar breaks down the options. Plus, local economic perspective with our own James B. Huntington. Chamber chats of the Northern Poconos. We chat with Rinker Inc. and a new concert series that combines performances, wellness, and nature for a one-of-a-kind experience. And while we met our summer fun drive goal, we're still looking for your help to ease a hole in our budget thanks to Congress defunding public media. Donate now at wjffradio.org. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Israel has refused to renew visas for the local heads of a number of United Nations agencies that operate in Gaza, according to a UN spokesperson. Israel blames or accuses these UN agencies of anti-Israel bias. The UN says it is being punished for its work helping Palestinian civilians. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has details.
Israel has not renewed the visas for the local heads of the UN Humanitarian Affairs Agency known as OCHA and the agency responsible for Palestinian refugees called UNRWA. In a statement, Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said, quote, there must be a limit, accusing OCHA of slander without providing further details. Tom Fletcher, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, told the UN Security Council last week in New York that besides delivering aid to civilians, its job was to witness and report on violations of international humanitarian law. Israel has long accused UNRWA of spreading anti-Israel hate, a claim UNRWA denies. Fletcher told the Security Council that OCHA faces threats every time it reports violations it sees in Gaza. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The National Weather Service is projecting potentially dangerous heat across much of the U.S., while storms and heavy rainfalls pose immediate threats in parts of the Midwest, all of it carrying the threat of flash floods. In the wake of the deadly 4th of July flooding in central Texas, disaster relief and preparedness is high on the agenda at a special state legislative session in Texas. Blaise Ganey of the Texas Newsroom and member station KUT is following.
The latest flood plan shows that more than $50 billion worth of plans are still pending. So it's not an easy fix. There will also be a lot of counties asking for help. Guadalupe is just one of the areas that is hit by floods pretty often. And after this recent tragedy, lawmakers know there's pressure to produce something.
Blaise Ganey reporting, the legislature will also consider other issues at President Trump's urging, including redrawing the state's congressional map that could favor Republicans in the 2026 midterms. Stocks open higher this morning at the start of a busy week for business report cards. Here's NPR's Maria Aspen.
Dozens of big companies, from Coca-Cola to Tesla, will report their quarterly earnings this week. Investors are watching to see how President Trump's new tariffs are affecting costs and profits. So far, some of the news has been better than expected. For example, Verizon reported revenue and profits that beat analysts' expectations. But automaker Stellantis is having a much rockier time. The company, which owns Jeep, Chrysler, and Dodge, says it expects to lose almost $2.7 billion in the first half of this year. It blames the loss in part on the early effects of U.S. tariffs.
That's Marie Aspen reporting. It's NPR. Ford is recalling nearly 700,000 Escape and Bronco Sport vehicles dating back to 2020. Industry authorities say the fuel injectors on some of the vehicles might crack, leak, and cause a fire. But Ford says it's not aware of anyone getting hurt as a result of the fuel injector issue. Ford says letters about the recall is expected to go out to Escape and Bronco Sport owners mid-August. President Trump is threatening to scuttle a plan to build a new stadium for Washington, D.C.'s professional football team if the team does not change its name back to the Washington Redskins. NPR's Rob Stein explains.
The team changed its name to the Washington Commanders after years of complaints that the original name was offensive to Indigenous Americans. But in two posts on the Truth Social network, the president threatened to, quote, put a restriction on the plan if the Commanders don't switch their name back. Congress recently gave the D.C. government control over federal land in the city for a multi-billion-dollar plan to redevelop the property into a new stadium. That would let the team move back to Washington from Maryland. It's unclear how Trump could scuttle the plan. Rob Stein, NPR News.
U.S. stocks are trading higher this hour, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average now up 165 points at 44,508. The S&P's climbed 32 points. The Nasdaq is up 151 points. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Sullivan County continues to face an urgent housing crunch. According to a 2024 study by Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress, more than 3,500 renter households are cost-burdened or severely cost-burdened by housing costs. The Sullivan County Legislature must now decide how to address this issue. Last year, the legislature allocated $2 million in local funds for affordable housing. Now they must decide how to spend it. There are a few options on the table: develop a housing trust fund, build a new affordable rental housing, or repair and rehab existing housing stock. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Heather Brown, Sullivan County Commissioner of Planning, Community Development, and Environmental Management, about the different options on the table and what it could mean for the county's housing supply.
Sullivan County has $2 million in appropriated county funds that it needs to spend for affordable housing in the county. They allocated these funds, I believe, sometime last year. They felt that affordable housing was an urgent issue. What are the different options that the county legislature is considering for how to spend that money?
So to get to that, I'm going to back up just a little bit to last year, 2024. And in the fall, the Sullivan County legislature voted and approved a local law that established affordable housing as a county purpose. And I think it's important that when we talk about affordable housing, we kind of identify what we're talking about with affordable housing. So the word affordable basically means 30% or less of any individual's gross annual income is housing that is affordable to them. And then you need to decide who the demographics are going to be that you're targeting to make housing affordable to. So that's one of the items that they're kind of grappling with right now. So we engaged the Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress to help us to structure a program of what this could look like if the county were to actually fund with local funds, flexible local funds, a housing program that sought to expand affordable housing opportunities in Sullivan County for a variety of individuals. What we've come up with are two different tracks. One that would be for rehabilitation of rental units, and one would be for new construction of rental units. For the rehabilitation of rental units, we'd be looking to target households that are at or below 80% of the median household income. For the construction of new rental units, it would be targeting folks who are at or below 60% of median household income. So those are the two programs that have been presented to the legislature for them to consider if they want to go after one, if they want to go after the other, or if they want to give themselves the flexibility to have both kind of on the books.
Right. And you mentioned the report from the nonprofit Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress. I took a look at that report. There's a lot of great information that's in there, including about how the rising cost of housing outpaces wages. Can you expand a little bit more about some of the key findings in the report that also informed your approach to affordable housing?
So in 2022, and this actually goes back to before I became commissioner for the Division of Planning, Planning had commissioned a housing strategy, the 2022 Sullivan County Housing Strategy, which was completed by a firm called CZB. And as you could expect, 2022, we're coming out of the pandemic. Things were starting to really ramp up. A lot of different pressures on the housing markets. Things were starting to get a little bit crazy. And we were realizing in that study that, you know, there was certainly this kind of lack of housing stock for first-time home buyers that were affordable, and this lack of units for folks who are kind of at the upper end of that workforce housing, that 60 to 80% to median household income, which was basically causing a logjam in our housing stock and the way that housing stock typically flows. Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress came in about a year and a half, 2 years later, and started to update those numbers. And as bad as those numbers were in 2022, they had gone really bonkers by the time that Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress had gotten involved. Last fall, I believe the median home sale price in Sullivan County eclipsed $300,000 for the first time in history. We've never had a median home price go that high before, but that is where we currently are hovering, just above that 300,000 number. So it kind of showed where this gap was and who are the people that we're talking about. When you talk about 60 to 80% to median household income, we're talking about the workforce of Sullivan County, the folks who provide the services that we all rely on, whether we're a business or a resident or a visitor, rely on these folks to provide critical services. Grocery clerks for our tourism industry, you know, you're talking about, you know, the food services industry, which is huge in Sullivan County, of course, during the summer months and anytime really. You're talking about mechanics, you're talking about home health aides, which is a really big deal given our rising senior population. So they were really kind of able to dig down into who are the folks who are becoming housing stressed in Sullivan County, and who are the folks who are really struggling to locate, you know, healthy, affordable, and reliable housing for themselves. And it's hitting our working class particularly hard right now. That was kind of what the impetus was for deciding that we wanted to take a hard look and see if there was a role for Sullivan County to address some of this this pressure.
Yeah. And I remember during the county legislative meeting, there was something that really stood out to me about condemned housing properties being one of the key contributors to the housing crunch, largely in part because of the lack of repairs for dilapidated rentals. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Sullivan County, we do have an aging housing stock. If you compare Sullivan County to some of our other counterparts in the Hudson Valley, our housing stock is considerably older. And given, you know, whatever circumstances, you know, homeowners may have, you know, that housing stock has not necessarily been maintained over the years. So we do tend to lose housing stock to dilapidation. What we're trying to identify is an easy way to, not an easy way, but some reliable way, I should say, to quantify that dilapidation outside of just the condemnation numbers, because a lot of times you see that a property isn't actually formally condemned. You just kind of look, there's a house that's, you know, falling down, the roof's caving in, and maybe that house has not been formally condemned by the municipality, but certainly it's not livable. And one of the items that was addressed by the Pattern for Progress, one of the items that was brought to our attention, is that Sullivan County, more so than our neighboring counties, has a tendency to lose housing stock to lack of maintenance, to dilapidation. And that only exacerbates an already high-pressured kind of situation.
I want to ask also about the possibility of developing a housing trust fund. I know we talked about, you know, building new affordable rentals or repairing and improving existing housing stock. I believe that there was some mention of a housing trust fund. Can you kind of just explain what that is and if that's something that's still on the table?
Sure. I would first say that I think all of these programs are still on the table. And a housing trust fund, the difference between a true housing trust fund and what could also be like a one-off kind of county program is that a trust fund has a dedicated source of revenue that will replenish that fund annually or as needed. So that would require the legislature to actually identify a source of revenue that they're going to say in the future, you know, this many dollars or this much percentage of these collections will be put into this fund specifically for the purpose of addressing affordable housing needs in Sullivan County. So that'd be a true trust fund. That is something that I believe is under consideration. It's still part of the conversation. The other options that are kind of out there would be that the county has $2 million. We can develop a program. It would be the same types of programs that you would develop, you know, for the housing trust fund. The difference would be is that when the money that's currently there is gone, it's gone and there's no real mechanism to necessarily replenish that funding. So the program would either be frozen or just go away. So that would be a one-time kind of injection of funding into the issue. And then there could be, you know, kind of a hybrid situation where maybe they say we're going to pilot this program with what we currently have available, see what the results are, and then from there, perhaps establish a true trust fund moving forward if we think that, you know, it's effective and it could address the housing needs. So those are just a couple of the options that are kind of on the table. And it's a lot of big decisions that they have to make. I will say our legislators, you know, they work very hard. They have a lot of priorities in front of them. I have my priorities in my division. Everyone has their priorities in their division and everyone has their own personal priorities and they have to balance all of those. They're going to, you know, really look at what the current, you know, state of the county is. There's a lot of decisions that they need to kind of weigh, and they've asked for some additional information from my office, which we're working on compiling, and we'll be happy to provide that information into the discussion, making sure that at the end of the day, they're making the most informed and most sound decision that they can. I think that it's important to get the decision correct as opposed to kind of rushed. So they've taken their time, but rightfully so.
Yeah, definitely. Heather, I'm curious what you or your team may have heard from residents directly about the need right now, especially for affordable housing.
We have inquiries all the time for folks who maybe they're homeowners, who, you know, in particular, a senior population. You have folks who are on a fixed income and they know that they have issues in their housing, that their homes that need to be addressed. So we hear a lot about we need repairs funding for homeowner occupied. We also get a lot of folks who come in that, you know, they're just asking, like, do you know of any rentals? I have two children and we're looking for a 3-bedroom and this is our budget. And a lot of times that budget just does not meet what is currently available on the market. And, you know, these folks are hardworking people and, you know, they're doing their job every day and they're raising their families and, you know, their budgets are not insignificant, but given what's available in the county, it's very, very slim pickings for some of the folks who are looking for, you know, just kind of everyday, ordinary, you know, moderate kind of income household housing. So we do hear the need and we know that the need is there. The stats show that the need is there. I know you saw that presentation that Pattern for Progress had kind of put together for us. And there's a lot of really good information that kind of demonstrates where these needs are.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm a renter myself. And when I was looking for, you know, affordable rentals, it's really a challenge here in Sullivan County. Well, I really thank you for the work that you and your department have been doing on this issue. I know it's an important one for so many people here in the county. Is there anything else that you want to add that maybe we haven't touched on?
The only thing I would say is, you know, when we're looking at these issues of housing, housing is something that is kind of omnipresent through so many different aspects of what we're looking at in community development. You know, housing is important, you know, really, you know, for residents, you know, quality of life, but it's also really important for our economy. You know, our partners at the Partnership for Economic Development, the Sullivan County Chamber of Commerce and the Sullivan County Visitors Association, they do a really great job in attracting people to Sullivan County and really just putting us on the map and making sure that our name is out there and under consideration. We want to have this housing available because housing needs to be there for your workforce. And without the workforce, you're not going to get the development that you need. I think that we're not at a point right now where it's, you know, it's preventing our development. But I want to make sure that never becomes the roadblock necessarily, right? I want to make sure that, you know, we have a thriving community, you know, with a well-trained workforce, and that they're able to live here and thrive here in Sullivan County and have some income, you know, left over after paying the mortgage or after paying the rent to, you know, go out onto Main Street and patronize our local businesses. So, you know, it's really important to look at housing, not just as a, oh, where are we going to house people, but how are we going to support our community and support our economy as well?
And thanks to Kimberly Izar for that report. Speaking to Heather Brown, Sullivan County Commissioner of Planning, Community Development, and Environmental Management. We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective with our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatsco.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we're going to hear the exotic percussion of Martin Denny, plus one of the great bongo records, Jazz Heat Bongo Beat. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Why not join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred? The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, why are countries like Saudi Arabia and China spending so much money on sports?
This is not just about kicking a ball. It's not even about trying to make a profit.
And we'll meet an American entrepreneur who's trying to take advantage.
It's an opportunity to export America's pastime.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, Mondays we check in with our own James B. Huntington, local economist and author. Working 9 to 5, what a way. Local economics perspective from James B. Huntington. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, let's talk about what happened with inflation last month. You've got the latest numbers there to share.
Well, it accelerated in June. We have an increase based on 2.7% from a year ago. That's the fastest since February's data. So we have core inflation having gone up 2.9% at an annual rate. So it's climbing up. The tariffs are taking effect in some places and having a toll on prices. So they are going up. If we look at the chart showing how much things went up over the month of June only, we have non-alcoholic beverages topping the list at 1.4%, fuel oil 1.3%, gasoline 1.0%, electricity 1.0%. Everything else was less than 1% over the month. The largest decreaser was used cars and trucks, which fell an average of 0.7%. So this looks like we are going to stay the same with interest rates. Everything that comes in seems to point toward not changing the interest rates one way or another. And the Fed is meeting later this month, so that's probably what we will see.
Well, we're talking about tariffs, and with the combination of that, the volatile dollar, the bond market being erratic, that's sort of shaken global investment thinking. So is the U.S. riskier than emerging markets?
Well, that was the exact title of a New York Times article that came out on Friday. So what we have here is, in some ways it may be, in some ways it may not be. It has done very well over the past decades, and in fact earlier this year in comparison with others. But we do have volatility in those things. The dollar has gone up and down. We had a day where everything on April 2nd went down. There were significant drops in stocks and treasury bonds and the U.S. dollar. That is so rare that it hadn't happened for 23 years before then. So that's a, a matter of concern. Its U.S. tariff rate and the effective overall is the highest even right now than it's been since the Great Depression. We don't know what will happen because a lot of these things get announced and threatened and then end up going away one way or another. In terms of market performance this year, the U.S. stock market is not the best anywhere. We have ones elsewhere in the world have been unusually good, and with the dollar generally dropping, it means it made U.S. stock values look worse in general from people in other countries. So we, if you include the idea that the volatility may cause price increases, it could look rather risky right now. We don't know exactly what will happen. The bottom line, the last paragraph, it said it makes sense to diversify.
Let's talk tech now. You got a couple of tech stories, including robots that can see inside sealed boxes. What is that all about, and why would we want a robot to see inside of a sealed box?
Well, MIT has now developed something which they can use to look at the shapes of things in boxes. It's called millimeter wave imaging, and it can ignore outside things and look inside to see with a radar-like thing where you look at the angles at which signals bounce back and you can discern the shape and size of what's inside the package. Now, mainly this is being described as something to use for detecting damage inside factories and such, to scan these things, and if something doesn't add up, it may be damaged once it's in a box and all ready to ship. So there obviously are some other applications to have. And it does not tell you a lot about these things, but if you have a box inside a box or an object, you can figure out the shape of it. This has not yet hit businesses yet, but it should be very soon.
Yeah, I guess also it could detect, if, you know, the safety of what's inside a package as well. One of the other things you've got to talk about is also a tech story, which I think I saw this story and it kind of concerned me, that they're using AI at rental car companies to find even like the tiniest of blemishes so they could charge you for that.
Well, this looks like a nuisance, and it may well not go over. It's not going over very well with customers at all, as you might imagine. We have Hertz now using something that started in the Atlanta airport, and it's spread to five things now. So what they do is take thousands of high-resolution images from all angles as a vehicle passes through the gates at pickup and return. If there are discrepancies, differences, that means something was different. Something probably has been damaged. It will look at it and bill the customer. Now, Hertz says that fewer than 3% of vehicles scanned by the AI system show any billable damage. This is the kind of thing where the appearance is so bad that it may wind up really offsetting the advantages here. We have a case story of somebody who rented a car, had no reason to think there was anything wrong with it. They saw no damage when they turned it in. The Hertz employee saw no damage, but they had detected a dent, the AI thing, on the passenger side front door, which precipitated a $195 charge. So they're saying when they saw the pictures that it could just have been a shadow. So we don't know. Now, What is painful, what is really a change, is that generally car rental agencies have been quite loose as far as small scratches and such things. They haven't really cared. You know, I mean, a vehicle that's used over and over and over again by a large number of people is going to have some small damage, some small things that aren't perfect about it, and everyone knows they're not going to go off and take it to get repaired. It's just whatever money they get will just be, will go to their bottom line, more or less. So I suspect this is not going to go at all. This will not work out. It just sounds like a worse thing, and in fact, yes, I mean, I think you should consider that the following rental car companies are saying they are not using any AI in their damage review process, and they are Enterprise, National, Alamo, Avis, Budget, and Payless, and Zipcar. None of those seven are using anything like this, so you may want to steer clear of Hertz as long as they have this thing, if you're at one of these airports, which you might want to find out.
Now, AI is everywhere. Let's talk scams, too. There's a lot of scams floating about now. Messages from your bank that might be bogus. It's always it's getting harder to tell, really. What are some of the messages that you might get from your bank that are scams?
Well, this is something where somebody on their phone got a message saying, "Dear Chase customer, our security systems have detected potential unauthorized activity on your account, blah, blah, blah. Will you request immediate verification? Please verify your account details." And they chose to not click on the link provided, contacted Chase, and Chase said it's a scam. So to look for these things, ideas are, one, the message creates urgency. Two, the link looks suspicious. It would not use miniature or shortened URLs. The tone or wording seems off. That's the biggest thing for me. You can tell when something has not been written professionally often. It asks for account verification, then you're in dangerous territory. It's a generic greeting to dear customer in this case. So there are things you can do to minimize your chance of getting these. Be cautious with links, filter suspicious messages, add another layer like two-factor authentication to your account security, remove your personal information from data broker sites, slow down when messages feel urgent. Everybody has a number of minutes to take a breath and look at the thing and possibly contact the company to make sure it's real. Regularly monitor your bank activity and educate family members, especially older adults. It seems like people in their 70s or 80s are the ones who bite on these things the most often, so you may need to tell them there are just a lot of dangerous and fake messages out there that you may get.
What are some of the top scams that are spreading right now that folks should be looking for, not just like from your bank? What are some other things that scammers are doing right now?
Okay, we have the AI voice clone. That one's a really sort of a gut punch. You get a call that sounds like someone you trust. They get a clip of your voice and replicate it. And they say something like, "Hi, it's me. I'm in big trouble. I need money. Don't tell anyone." And they're looking for a way they will tell you how they can be wired or got money. Ways to deal with that. One that's really good is ask them something they'll know that AI wouldn't suspect or know for. I got a bad message from an old high school classmate one time. I wasn't really sure, though. It was good enough that I wasn't sure if he was really contacted me. And I responded with, "What position did you play in high school football?" And he the thing elected not to answer it, where it would have been a snap off the top of his head from the real person. Think about things like that, that they're going to know that AI isn't going to have, and just something from shared experiences or something about the home, if it's a relative that they lived in. Three, a crypto investment friend. That is showing you something, some way of making a massive amount of money at crypto. Well, it's always the same kind of thing there. It's why do they need you? If any, that's the question that should kill any suspicious investment things. Why you? They're offering you what they call as a great massive opportunity to make a ton of money. Well, why? I mean, they could just make it themselves because it's not for real. The previous one is related to as before. Your bank account's frozen immediately and you need information. There are some ways that banks just will not contact you. Also, yeah. Four, a gold bar scam. You get a call from saying they're with the FBI or your bank's fraud team, and they say your money is at risk and you need to withdraw it, convert it into gold bars, and turn it over for safekeeping. I mean, it doesn't sound like anyone should bite on this,
no.
But we have a 72-year-old retiree who did that to the tune of, believe it or not, $3
million. Wow. Oh,
so law enforcement doesn't operate that way. That's the short thing. And five, a vet emergency. A neighbor's crying, your dog's been hit by a car. They rushed him to the vet, paid the bill, and you owe them $1,200. But then on closer examination, your dog is sleeping on the couch. So take steps to verify these things. Call said neighbor and ask if this thing really happened, something like that.
Yeah, these things.
And if you can tell what a normal person, just your basic private party, answers their cell phone as opposed to some compound or something where you'll get strange things if they dial. So even if they give you a bad callback number, you should be able to figure it out. But these things are out there, so be careful. Be skeptical.
Yeah, they're spreading a lot. All right, let's talk about the numbers. What were stock, oil, precious metal, and crypto prices this morning, and how did they change?
Okay, as of early this morning, we have one-week spreads. Gold, $33.64. When rounded to the nearest dollar, it was exactly the same as a week before. Silver, $38.37, down 54 cents. The ratio is now 88-1. It got a little higher with silver getting lower. So, but silver's gained a lot. It may have some up and down remaining, even if it will hang out somewhere around these prices. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 44,342, down all of 30. Generally a quiet week. Everything balanced out. Our president's yakkings offset any general interest it has in going up, and it didn't go anywhere. NASDAQ, 20,896 for up 310, did quite a bit better. I mean, a lot of NASDAQ really lives and dies on what's happening with AI, and it may have been a positive week. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $67.01, down $2, bringing it back almost exactly to where it was 2 weeks ago. I saw $2.73 a gallon in New Jersey, so these lower prices are, in some places, making it to pumps. Bitcoin, $118,919, down $3,600 and some. It had a lot to give back. It could do that again, and it would still be way up for the year. British pound, 1.3444, down 27 hundredths of a cent. Slightly better dollar. Euro, 1.1637, down 42 hundredths. Much the same there. And the Japanese 100 yen coin sat once again being as torpid as usual at 68 cents. Overall, a peaceful week, but Don't count on that continuing.
Well, never count on that. James B., you're always out there looking for us. Thanks so much for joining us today. And I think you're taking a break, so we'll see you in a couple weeks here.
Yes, you will.
All right.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
James B. Huntington, Local Economic Perspective. And we'll take a break and back with more Radio Chatskill after this.
I'm Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR. At the White House's request, Congress just voted to eliminate all federal funding for public media. This decision by Congress hurts communities across the country. It means fewer voices that dare to ask difficult questions or reflect on the full richness of who we are as a nation. Fewer stories about what connects us and brings us closer together. And for millions, especially those in rural areas, it means losing access to trusted local news, emergency alerts, and the everyday connection and companionship that public media provides. But here's what will never change. Our commitment to you. NPR and public media exist to serve the American public, to bring you rigorous journalism without fear or favor, to connect communities in moments of both crisis and joy. Public media has always been powered by the people it serves, people like you and me, who believe in a free and independent press. So I'm asking you to act now. Your donation will make an immediate difference. You will ensure public media remains free and accessible to all. You will enable this essential American service to survive and thrive. Please go to this station's website and give what you can. We are here because of you. To serve you. And with your help, we always will be.
Radio Catskill needs you now more than ever. Please stand with us. Keep public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, it's Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR. Federal funding for public media has been eliminated. That means that the NPR network is moving forward in an uncharted future. But our commitment to you will never waver. Please give today to support the kind of journalism that democracy relies upon. Here's how to make your gift to this station. And thank you.
Make your donation at WJFFradio.org.
And thank you for your support. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, in Margaretville, New York, they're celebrating their 150th anniversary, and our own culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Diane Galusha about the coming activities and celebrations.
Good morning, Diane, and welcome to WJFF's Radio Chatskill.
Good morning to you. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, it's nice to have you back. And as president of the Historical Society of the town of Middletown, in Delaware County, you must have a lot on your plate because next weekend, July 26th, are having a huge event. Tell us about that.
Okay. This is the sesquicentennial, the 150th anniversary of the incorporation of the village of Margaretville, which is in the town of Middletown. So I and others at the Historical Society are working with the Central Catskills Chamber of Commerce and the Village of Margaretville Board to put together a celebration of this milestone. So it's going to be July the 26th, that Saturday, a week from tomorrow, from 4 to 7 in the evening. And it's going to involve all kinds of fun stuff. Going to be starting at 4 o'clock with a community portrait, kind of a snapshot of anybody in the community that would like to be in it. That's going to be in front of the iconic Bussey Building, beautiful Victorian structure on Main Street. And it will be the third such community portrait that has been taken over the past 50 years or so. So we're looking forward to adding to that photographic record of our village. So after the photograph is taken, The band will begin. Sue's Garage is a good rock band, and they're going to be playing so that people can dance in the street. The main street will be blocked off for a few blocks, and so there'll be all kinds of stuff, activities and sidewalk sales and, food, several food purveyors. And so we're hoping for good weather so people can sit on the picnic tables and listen to the music and have something to eat and enjoy art and other exhibits in the village.
I also saw that there's an artist tour.
That is a separate event, but yes, it is happening kind of simultaneously. That's a weekend event. That's the Andy's Margaretville Roxbury Studio Art Studio Tour, which happens every year. That runs on Saturday and Sunday, I think maybe from 10 to 5. So for an hour or so of that tour, tour goers, if they come late in the day to Margaretville, can, you know, park somewhere on the outskirts. There's parking at lots in Freshtown Supermarket, the Village Park, and other areas. They can park and then walk to these, I think there are four or five artist studios and galleries that are participating in that art studio tour in the Main Street area. So they certainly will be open and will be accessible to tour goers.
And there are so many things. I love this phrase I picked up. It's play, shop, eat, drink, and dance at the 150th birthday block party. I thought that sounded so energetic and inviting. You know, I also noted there'll be vintage cars, and there'll be...
It's not going to be a huge car show, but there will be vintage cars there on display. There will be kids' activities right next door to that display at the Fairview Library. There'll be, people will be able to have access to the Binnakill, which is a stream that runs through town. There's a little park there. There'll be, activities here and there. Merchants will be putting together like craft maker activities. So lots of interesting food. We have a couple of new restaurants opening up on Main Street too. So it will be an opportunity to showcase their new menus.
Wonderful. Well, it sounds like a wonderful event, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And whenever there's dancing involved, we know it's going to be good. For all of us.
You bet.
Yes. Well, thank you, Diane, for taking the time to speak with us about it. And also, I look forward to having you back because I saw that you will be doing a presentation at Woodchuck Lodge in the fall.
John Burroughs Woodchuck Lodge, yes, in Roxbury. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that will be on the reservoirs and water?
Well, actually, title is Papacton River and Reservoir. So East Branch of the Delaware River was once known as Papacton, or variations on that name. And John Burroughs, who was the famous naturalist born in Roxbury, once built a boat and rode it down the East Branch all the way to the main stem of the Delaware, to the community of East Branch, I should say. And so he wrote about that adventure and the people he encountered along the way, and the weather and the animals and all of that. It's a wonderful, fascinating account. And I hope to compare his observations with what is there today and along much of that route that he paddled. It is the Papacton Reservoir, New York City's largest reservoir. So a lot of what John Burroughs saw in that little river adventure is no longer visible, obviously. He went past communities that are no longer there. So that's what the talk is going to be about, a little bit of a comparison of the two.
Wonderful. Well, we'll have you back again to talk to our listeners about it.
Well, thank you. That'd be fun. I look forward to it.
Okay, you are welcome.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that, speaking to Diane Galusha about Margaretville's 150th birthday celebration and more. We'll take a break, and when we come back, a new concert series that combines performances, wellness, and nature for a one-of-a-kind experience. This is Radio Chatskill.
The 19th century philosopher John Stuart Mill once said, "Ask yourself whether you are happy, and you cease to be so."
And he said, those only are happy who have their minds fixed on some object other than their own happiness.
The Path to True Happiness, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Outlier Inn has long been a creative sanctuary for musicians seeking inspiration in nature. Now, founder Josh Struckman is opening its doors to the public in a whole new way. This summer, the Outlier Inn is launching Outlier Concerts, a series of intimate week-long immersive experiences. Guests just won't attend concerts, they'll live them. Hotelier, recording engineer, and farmer Josh Struckman joins us now. Josh, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Tim. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being here. Tell folks again about what inspired you to create the Outlier Inn all the way back in 2002.
Yeah. I had been operating a commercial recording studio in New York City, and right after September 11th, I closed the studio and moved up here to Sullivan County, where I had spent summers as a kid up in Parksville, and have a long history with my family in Sullivan County. They owned a summer camp in Parksville in the 60s and 70s, and I spent summers up here as a kid, always loved it, and I moved up here in 2002 by myself, didn't know anyone. I was 26 years old at the time, and built a small recording studio here on my property just for me, and pretty quickly started realizing how incredible it was to be making music up here in the country and in nature, and started inviting friends up from the city to join me in that experience. And then as the way things go, as a recording studio, you need to buy equipment and more equipment and more equipment. So what started out as a small personal studio, I began running it as a semi-commercial facility, and then every single session just reinforced the fact that musicians loved being out of the city, being in nature. It was fun, it was inspiring, it was productive, and so I just kept doubling down. And over the last 23 years that I've been here on my property in just outside of Mountaindale, my small personal studio has now grown into two fully commercial recording studios, and musicians from all over the world are coming here to Sullivan County to stay and make records.
Yeah, if you look at the website, that Studio A board is, I think, maybe a quadruple the size of the board we have here in the studio.
Yes, it's large.
How has the space evolved from a retreat for musicians into, you know, this idea of outlier concerts? And talk about the combination of music and wellness and nature and sort of living the concerts.
Sure. I'm really excited about this concert series. It is, and it's something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and it's really the next natural evolution of this property. In addition to hosting musicians here, I pretty early on I started just hosting nightly guests and also retreats and all different types of retreats and events, and a lot of wellness retreats, a lot of food-based retreats. But it was always outside organizers coming and finding me and booking time here, and I served as a venue. And now I'm transitioning into becoming more of a producer of events here. And a year and a half ago, I built an outdoor amphitheater, which has gotten used for lots of different purposes, wellness retreats and wedding ceremonies. But my goal with it was to host concerts. And so last October, I did kind of a soft launch for the amphitheater and put on a kind of proof of concept concert. And it was absolutely sensational with a band from West Africa, Fomoro Diabate. And it was just a magical night. And so I decided that I wanted to kind of put together, kind of formalize and produce on my own, combine all the elements of things that are going on here anyway, music, food, wellness, and a retreat, accommodations. So with Outlier Concerts, we are offering just night passes for people who want to come and just attend the concerts. But the big idea is more of a full weekend immersive experience where a ticket buys you two nights accommodations, five meals, a series of concerts throughout the weekend, and then a wellness experience, which is a yoga class, and a studio deep listening experience. You know, there are all of these listening bars now, which have become very, very popular, and we have an absolutely world-class acoustic environment here in the recording studio. So as part of the weekend, people can come in, listen to vinyl records in a world-class acoustic environment and learn a little bit about the process and just kind of spend the whole weekend here in the country for the purpose of, you know, music, live music and recorded music.
Yeah, more than a concert, more than a festival. Talk about the lineup and where folks can get more information.
Sure. Well, lineup and information and tickets are available on my website, outlierin.com. That's outlierin.com. We had two Outlier Concerts, full immersive concert weekend scheduled for this summer. Unfortunately, the first concert weekend has to be postponed because the headlining artist, Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, she had a last-minute scheduling conflict. So now we've moved the supporting artist, who's June McDoom, an incredible songwriter, singer.
Great name, too. She's going to be performing.
Yeah, June McDoom. She's going to be performing on our second, what was our second weekend, which is now our inaugural weekend, which is August 8th through 10th. We have Nick Hakim headlining. He's an incredible piano player, kind of psychedelic R&B. He's made a couple of records here in the studio over the years. He's going to be joined by Eddie Chacone, who's an amazing soul singer, whose last album was produced by Nick Hakim. And then June McDoom is going to be opening along with Marim Ladson, who's another Galician singer-songwriter. So it's a really exciting lineup.
We got to go, but before we do, you've been hosting musicians for over 20 years. What's your favorite part of welcoming people into this space that you've built from scratch?
That's a great question. I think my favorite thing is just welcoming them to Sullivan County and the Catskills, and really the feeling that I have when I'm here, the inspiration, the life force that it's brought me, and the happiness that it's brought me over the last 23 years and continues to bring me every day, is you just feel it when the musicians get out of the car. They take that first deep breath and they look at the trees and they see the animals here on the farm and they smell the air, and it's a perfect, perfect setting for them to be creative. And so that's the part that makes me the happiest.
Josh Druckman, the Outlier Inn with Outlier Concerts this summer. There's more information at outlierinn.com. Josh, thanks for joining us. Yeah.
Thanks so much.
That's it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and reminder, you can donate and help us fill our funding gap at wjffradio.org. And for everyone that's donated so far during our summer fund drive, thank you so much. Your support and your comments have been gratifying and uplifting to everybody on the team. So help us continue to donate and fill that gap, as we need to fill a pretty big hole in our budget, but we know we can do it with the support of the community like you. 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. narrowsburgunion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, I'm co-star Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me. The Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, a nice couple of days in the forecast. Sunny skies this afternoon, cooler and less humid, high 74, clear and a low of 50 tonight. Tomorrow, generally sunny and a high of 74 as well. On Point is next from WBUR in Boston. It's 11 o'clock at Radio Catskill.